Hey everyone, this is The Book Pile, a podcast about the best of books and the worst of books. If this is your first time to the podcast, welcome. And if you've been a fan, that you know that we're currently on a schedule where my podcast partner, Dave Vance, appears every other week. This is an off week, but he'll be back next week as we discuss the second Hunger Games book, Catching Fire. I know that doing a reissue of an episode might be disappointing to some fans who have already heard these. Just know that I've been reissuing episodes for a reason these past few weeks, but I'll be back to doing at least brand new solo episodes soon. Plus, as with the others, this one has been digitally remastered and re-edited for a better listen, and I've curated them from our collection of almost 200 episodes. I think it's one of our best from the first 100. And I really did enjoy making this Lord of the Rings episode, which was originally released on July 4th, 2022, I guess because we were celebrating the independence of Middle Earth. And this one, we debate how much of a hero Frodo is. We discuss the good and bad decisions made when it was adapted to film. Also, Sauron's oversight with security on Mount Doom. And at one point, I pitch an alternate ending, which I think Peter Jackson needs to hear. Real quick, we have a Patreon for The Book Pile, which you can check out in the link for this episode. And on the newest bonus episode, bonus episodes are available exclusively on the Patreon. I've posted a few minutes of audio from a recent stand-up show where I spoke with a woman in the audience who was afraid of giraffes. Speaking of shows, if you want to see me live, I'm going to be in Sunnyvale, California next week at Rooster Teeth Feathers. I think that's May 30th through June something. And then a couple weeks after that, I'm going to be in Winnipeg, Manitoba at Rumors Comedy Club. I believe that's June 11th through the 15th. You can find tickets at KellenErskine.com. All right. And now, without further ado, here is me and Dave.
Hey, everyone. On the list of dumb villains has to be the guy who put his whole soul into a ring, lost it, and who controls the only volcano where it can be destroyed and doesn't even put, like, a tarp over it. Today's book is The Return of the King by J.R.R.R. Tolkien.
And this is The Book Pile. I'm Kellen Erskine. I'm a comic and a father who is currently in the middle of reading this and struggling to maintain a storyline to my young child where King Theoden is still alive. He's just on vacation now with Cedric Diggory. I don't know what I'm going to do when we hit book 7.
And I'm David Vance. I can tell Tolkien was British because he's like, you know what would solve these people's problems is a good old-fashioned king. All right, quick reminder to tell your friends about The Book Pile, unless your friends give one-star reviews.
Podhost 1 says, Dave, I will buy your 2012 Camry.
No, I'm trying to sell a Corolla. I'm saving up for a Camry.
All right, and without further ado, here are four lessons that we took from The Return of the King, which Tolkien originally called The War of the Ring, and which I call The Downfall of the Evil Lighthouse. All right, lesson one, tie up loose ends. So this is great advice whether you're in the mob or into taxidermy. So what I mean by that, don't leave anything to the imagination. Explain the end of every single story that you start. I'm actually mostly serious about this. Tolkien, I appreciate how incredibly thorough he is. But I discovered how many stories were really being told in this when I realized how many ends were tied up. So here are a few. Aside from the obvious ones, Frodo destroys the ring, Aragorn becomes king. There's a story of Faramir who loses a brother, disappoints his father by not dying, and then meets Eowyn in the hospital, and they get married. Then there's Eowyn's story of her almost dying and then settling on marrying Faramir because she can't have Aragorn.
Hey, none of us can.
Not to mention, like, Bilbo and his retirement, Merry and Pippin becoming war heroes, Gollum becoming the biggest accidental war hero of all time. I'm sure I'm missing a dozen others. By the way, Dave, how do you, I don't mean to be controversial about this, but how do you feel about the epic end? Frodo doesn't actually overcome the ring. He gets it so far, and then he's like, no, I'm going to take over now. And then Gollum bites his finger off. I mean, I'm okay with it because I've always just loved the story, but it is interesting to sort of think of it in that way. Like, if Gollum hadn't come there at the very end, would Sam mm-hmm. have had the courage to bite off Frodo's hand?
It doesn't cheapen it for me for two reasons. I think one is Frodo got it all the way to that last step and then just needed a little bit of help at the end. And so for me, it's like, yeah, Frodo really struggled with this ring like everybody did. And he got it most of the way there and then was helped at the end.
By a freak accident.
Yeah. Also, these were the books that made me want to be a writer as a kid. So I'm sure I'm going to bend over backwards to justify.
No, I love it too. It just that just struck me this last time reading it. Because I've seen the movies more than I've read the books. And I feel like in the movie, they didn't portray his like temptation at the very end as powerfully as it is in the book, where he's like, I'm the master now. I wonder if Gollum, as he's falling to his death, was like, why didn't I bite Frodo's finger off like 100 miles ago?
I just couldn't believe that Sauron has the one thing that can destroy the ring and doesn't keep like a guard. No,
that is funny. And there is that moment in the book where Frodo puts on the ring. He says, this is mine now. Sauron focuses his attention on the entrance and Tolkien says he regretted that decision. It's like, yeah, making like a trail and a doorway to the ring destroying place.
Yeah, why did he make it easy to access? I think about that with Harry Potter 1, where McGonagall could have just made stone guys that beat you up if you try to get through. But she's like, no, no. If they're smart enough, they've earned this.
There's such a parallel too with Sauron, because he, I mean, he can't even fit in that door. He's a tower.
That's probably why it was a blind spot. He thought no one else could.
That's what happens when you don't have empathy.
How are they going to drop it in with their eyeball also?
So it's easy to make fun of the movie for having like 7 different endings, because that is basically what happens in the book. I think a compromise for the movie, though, could have been like if they did it in the style of every film about a bad high school sports team that becomes a good high school sports team. And then during the credits, it's like Chris Turndale went on to win the Heisman. Joss Ferguson, right? But with Lord of the Rings, like I would have ended it with the ring in the lava. And then it would have been like, Samwise went home and married that girl he mentioned twice. Merry led the fight to rid the Shire of evil. Frodo hung out for a bit, then sailed away from all his friends.
As it's happening, you're seeing that the real life Aragorn was much uglier. All right, lesson 2. Who would you become if there were no consequences? This whole series, Sam Gamgee is this humble, happy-go-lucky gardener. He's a good friend. He's loyal. In fact, he's so loyal, he keeps calling Frodo master, even though Frodo is not still paying him to garden. So Sam's, he's a great guy. Then he has the ring for 1 second. He immediately starts thinking of himself as Samwise the Strong. He can do what he wants. He can raise an army and conquer Mordor and be a celebrity. Basically, his heart is totally good until he could get away with being bad. Now, Sam makes the right choice, but I think this is actually one of the main ideas of Lord of the Rings. Kellen, did you ever hear about the Ring of Gyges?
No.
It's this legend Plato tells where this normal guy finds a ring that makes him invisible. and he immediately kills the king and seduces the queen. And it basically says, would you still be good if there were no consequences? Which I think is one of the central ideas of this book. Mm-hmm. So Kellen, personal question I want to ask, what illegal or bad thing do you worry you might do if there were no consequences?
Well, I think I gave a hint of this on our episode of The Illustrated Man when I talked about what I would do on my last day on Earth, and you were very unimpressed. I would basically do elaborate pranks. Like if I hired a skywriting company to just spell swear words all over LA County.
That's a really good idea. I'm sure they have a policy just for people like you.
I guess that's what Kellen the Strong would do with his. I like to think that it is my conscience and not the law that keeps me from doing bad things, right. But now I don't know.
I like to think that too. So like in dating, I try to be, you know, considerate and nice. And there are times I worry, would I still do that if I were like an NBA player? I hope I would. But you never know what you would do with power till you have it.
And you can't just say that on a date, like, I'm polite because I have a lot to lose.
Lord of the Rings is all about how power corrupts. I think another way of saying that is, power is when bad things stop happening to you when you do evil. And I think that's when you find out how good of a person you actually are. Mm. If it were me, I'm worried that I would for sure do drugs.
There's a real life example of that. There's like that legend that like it's red cars that get pulled over the most. And it's not. It's just the richest people get pulled over the most because they don't mind paying speeding tickets. It's not a consequence anymore.
They think of it as speeding premium. It does seem like since most people have a similar response to power, which is letting themselves do more bad things, maybe the smart move isn't trying to be such a good person that power doesn't corrupt you. Maybe the smart move is trying to build in checks and balances so you can never be that unchecked. Mm-hmm. Anyway, if this idea intrigues or horrifies you, check out the book Everybody Lies, because when we think no one's watching, we have some horrifying Google searches.
All right. Lesson 3, beware of considering yourself the standard. So I have this theory that the only people we call nerds are the people who are nerdier than we are. I just think nerd is such a relative title. Relative in the sense that, like, consider the average time that you arrive at work or at class every day. You judge everyone who comes later than you as lazy and everyone who comes before you as a show-off. You are the standard. I figured that out about myself because me and my wife and our kids, we usually show up, you know, 4 minutes before church starts. But then on the one Sunday where we do show up 10 minutes ahead of time, everyone who shows up after me, I'm like looking at my watch passive aggressively. Like, oh, I'm sorry. Are you too busy for the Lord?
It sounds like church is making you a really good person.
So I found myself on both sides of this coin while reading and researching this book. Because on the one hand, I love it. I love the incredible world. He's created the thousands of years of rich history. But the other side of that coin is the part of me going, like, really? Who's reading this 200-page appendix? Which is crazy because it's like saying, I just read 1,100 pages like a regular cool person, not 1,300 like a square. And it really hit me when I was looking up what those dragons were called that the Nazgul ride on. The short article popped up that says, quote, they are called fell beasts. Fell beasts are monstrous wyvern-like creatures that were bred by Sauron to be steeds for his lieutenants, the Nazgul. They were not truly dragons, but rather creatures from an older time, long past in Middle-earth. And as soon as I was like a sentence and a half in, I was rolling my eyes like, okay, thanks, Milhouse. Again, just crazy. It's so easy to think that what you know is like the exact right amount. So anyone doing extra work is wasting their time. Because, again, I read this entire book, but then I read these two extra things. I'm like, yeah, right. Pushing the glasses up on my forehead. But with the fell beast, I actually think...
I literally pushed glasses up my forehead as you said that.
That's just like the...
That's so mean.
I hope that you say actually every time you do that. But I think it also depends on the thing. I think everyone is a nerd about something. I'm a casual Lord of the Rings fan, so I'll make fun of people who memorize the Silmarillion or who are correcting my pronunciation of it right now. But I'm a huge comedy nerd. And if someone's like, my favorite comedian is Ben Stiller, I'm pretty quick to be like, well, technically, he's not a comic. He's a comedic actor. I'm a comedian.
Am I your favorite now?
It's fun to be a nerd and desperate. What's something you think you're a nerd about?
I had the thought one day that I probably know more economics than most comedians, and I'm probably funnier than most economists. And what a sad intersection that is. I was like, is that my thing?
And if I could call Tolkien a nerd for a second here, because there's a really nerdy thing he does in one of the last chapters. He's not great at love stories, which is fine. Everyone, I think, should stay in their lane. Neither was Crichton or Stephanie Meyer, but it's really obvious here with Tolkien. So at this point in the story, there hasn't been any physical romance for, you know, a good 1,000 pages. And we get to this moment where Faramir is holding Eowyn in a street in Gondor. And keep in mind, they're both grown adults. And Tolkien says, quote, he kissed her under the sunlit sky, and he cared not that they stood high upon the walls in the sight of many, and many indeed saw them. It's like, ooh. In this book, up to this point, there have been about 37 wars, and yet another example of incredible courage. A man kisses a woman in front of people.
She was probably nervous that Aragorn would see. All right, lesson four. When you're good enough at your job, people just have to tolerate your bad decisions. This is a short one. This book is 214 pages long. The ring is destroyed on page 108. Half of this book is just winding down. And Tolkien is so good at world building that we all just have to tolerate that. So my lesson is, if you become amazing at your job, you get to be self-indulgent because they can't replace you. It's like how Lin-Manuel Miranda is so good at making musicals that he also gets to sing and no one can say no.
So I get that, and I think I half agree with you. First of all, it's like the editors made, and I think to their credit, they made Tolkien split his one giant book into three smaller books.
Sure.
So it feels like less of a longer ending when, you know, relative to the 1,000 total pages. That being said, I do appreciate the sort of hero's journey that continues to happen with the hobbits. I do love that part of the story that the movies cut out completely. Merry and Pippin really come back, literally a master of both worlds. And they break through the gate and they're like, there's a new sheriff in town. You know, when before they were just sort of these little pipsqueak guys messing around with Dumbledore's fireworks, you know?
Gandalf's?
Oh, I wish I would have said that as a joke, but I really said that. And discredited my entire point.
All right, random facts. You can tell Tolkien is a veteran because he has a whole storyline that's like, if you're a draft dodger, you'll become a ghost in the mountains till you fight a bloody war.
Speaking of wars, Tolkien and C.S. Lewis both fought in World War I, and they were good friends afterwards, even though they were on opposing sides. No, just kidding. But it's so funny to me when people compare the two. I have an appreciation for some of C.S. Lewis's stuff, but it doesn't compare. Tolkien created a universe, you know, these immense histories that go through centuries, cultures and original languages that he has come up with, this massive undertaking that literally took decades to complete. So I just don't see how you can compare that to like The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe. When those kids are in trouble, it's like, what's and Santa Claus came to help them.
Tolkien does that thing Shakespeare does a lot where he thinks when someone is in a slight disguise, everyone becomes an idiot. Eowyn puts on some armor and suddenly Mary has face blindness. Kellen, think of a woman you've talked to multiple times. If she put on shoulder plates, what are the odds you wouldn't recognize her for 4 days? Shakespeare is even worse because he's like, oh yeah, if my wife ever put her hair up, I wouldn't know who she was.
Yeah, speaking of that moment in the movie, these movies to me might be the best book to film adaptation.
Yeah, I think I agree. They definitely cut out all the parts I hate.
Yeah. All the songs in every single meal that they had and where they got it and how good it tasted. One choice that I didn't like. So in the book, all of us find out at the same time when Eowyn pulls her helmet off and says, I am no man. In the book, it's but no living man am I. She sort of says it how Yoda would. Mm-hmm. But that's the moment when the reader discovers too. And it's this huge reveal to everyone, including Mary and the Nazgul. The movie is more realistic from what you're saying that, yeah, the moment she pulls Mary up onto the horse, he's like, oh, soft hands. He knows that it's her.
I don't know how you do that in the movie without it being immediately clear that, oh, I guess Mary is an imbecile.
Yeah. But to me, like us knowing so far in advance, like it does pull that punch a little bit. Imagine at the beginning of Star Wars, A New Hope, if Obi-Wan turned to the camera and whispered to us like, Darth Vader is Luke Skywalker's dad. And then the first time watching Empire Strikes Back, all of us just would have been there to see Luke get surprised.
I get what you're saying. I do just think the movie is just harder to pull that off. This is a spoiler for Ready Player One, so skip ahead if you don't want this spoiled. But one of the big twists is that he finds out his best guy friend in this VR world is actually a woman. And it's a big twist in the book. But in the movie, you start watching and you hear the first couple lines and you're like, oh, that's a woman using a voice distorter. Yeah.
So the Nazgul, they start riding on those fell beasts only after their horses got washed away, which is crazy. Isn't that like, oh crap, we crashed all our go-karts. I guess now we have to resort to flying these private jets.
It definitely feels like the Black Riders were those kids at college trying to hide how rich they are.
What if the way the fell beast died was actually like it just started raining and the Black Riders are like, again, our animals, none of them are waterproof.
Oh, yeah, it makes you wonder why Rivendell can't make that river turn into dragons.
They're not dragons, they're fell beasts. I'm not wearing glasses, so I pushed my contact up my face. So here are a couple of my favorite insults from the book. At one point, Merry, now that he's returned to the Shire, a big little tough guy, he goes up to one of the new town bullies and he says, "We know how to deal with foot pads like you."
I bet as soon as he said that, he's like, "Oh, I could have done better than that."
And then this is what Treebeard calls the orcs. He says, "Those evil-eyed, black-handed, bow-legged, faint-hearted, claw-fingered, foul-bellied, bloodthirsty, morumuktelokahum," which I think is racist.
Yeah, that's going to end his political career.
He's like, "I didn't know that Bilbo was going to write it down in his book."
It was a different time.
It was a different time. So Bilbo's response to Aragorn's wedding invitation was so relatable for me because he says, quote, "I was invited to the wedding, of course, but when it came to it, I found that I had so much to do here and packing is such a bother." I just hate going to weddings. Also, I love that he says that he has so much to do, but he really doesn't do that much. And even then, when Frodo came by at the end of the book, Bilbo was like, "Hey, do you think you could finish my book for me?"
What have you been doing?
Not only does he ask Frodo if he could finish his book for him, he follows it up with, "I promise I won't be too critical." And it's like, no, you don't get to be at all. You're asking someone to, you know how hard it is to write a book? That would be like, "Hey, could you take me to the airport? I promise I won't make fun of how you drive for most of the ride." So when Frodo leaves Middle Earth, he sails away with the elves to the Undying Lands. And the Undying Lands, to me, it's like a heaven place that sounds the most like hell.
It sounds like where you would tell your kids your dog went. Now that I think so about sad. It, you definitely tell your kids that, huh?
No, I just get them a new dog that looks exactly like Cedric.
All right, to recap our favorite lessons from The Return of the King. 1, tie up loose ends. 2, who would you become if there were no consequences? 3, beware of considering yourself the standard. 4, when you're good enough at your job, people just have to tolerate your bad decisions.
And 5, if you want to always be right, wear glasses.